Welcome to another edition of Hamilton Spectator Newsroom Insider. I'm John Wells. In this episode, award-winning reporter Joanna Friketich breaks out her calculator, or abacus, or whatever the kids are using nowadays, and talks about her hot-button education series, EQAO, The Math Problem. I also sit down with Paul Burton to talk about the Spectator's 88-page special section marking Canada's 150th birthday. And, for the occasion, I also ask the Spec's editor-in-chief to reflect a bit on his father, Pierre Burton, the iconic Canadian author and historian. And finally, in a piece titled A Reporter's Journey in Canada Town, I read a personal essay I wrote for that section that reflects on Hamilton's place in the country, including my humble suggestion that Steeltown is the most Canadian city there is. First up, sharpen your pencils as we do the math with Joanna Friketich. Hey, Joanna, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me here.
So your three-part series titled The Math Problem launched on Thursday, and part three runs in Saturday Spectator, correct?
Yes, it does.
So congratulations on the reporting you've done on this, certainly. Now, your specialty at the Spec is healthcare.
Yes, it is.
But you wear a variety of hats.
Yes,
and
yes, we all do.
Yeah, we all do. That's right.
These days.
Talk a little bit about how this series came together and why you did it.
Well, while I'm a health reporter, health and education, I find, do have some links, especially when it comes to socioeconomic factors and you know, education is a key factor in health. So education is something that's always interested me, and I'm also a mom, so I have kids in the education system, so it interests me that way. But really, what made me interested in looking at this was that the EQA numbers, when they came out, it was quite some time ago that they came out. I was absolutely shocked by the math numbers. You know, you're talking about a provincial average for grade six math of like 50%, and less than that in Hamilton. And I was just thinking, you know, how can this be that we have, you know, half or more of our students failing to meet provincial standards in math? I was just staggered by that. Mm-hmm. And so that is what sort of motivated me to decide to take a closer look at this in Hamilton and Burlington, and to get a better idea of the scope of the problem and maybe what some of the causes are of it, and what's being done to fix it, especially considering it's such a long-standing problem.
And EQA stands for Education Quality and Accountability.
Office, yes, EQAO.
Yeah. And so this is explain that, how that works first of all.
So EQAO is standardized testing that's done every single year, and it's done in grades 3 and 6 in reading, writing, and math, and it's done in grade 9 in math, and there's also a literacy test you have to pass to graduate from high school. So those are the annual tests that are done, and the idea is to give an idea of how many students are passing the benchmark, you know, how many are meeting expectations. What it's really looking at, when you're looking at grade 3 math, there's a place where the province would like you to be at by the end of grade 3. So it's sort of measuring your math from grade 1, 2, and 3. And then for grade 6, they want to see, you know, are you up to the benchmark they think you should be at that point. And for those grades, the testing doesn't actually count towards your marks. In high school, it's a bit different, but in elementary school, it doesn't count towards your marks. It's more of a measure to see where are kids when it comes to the curriculum expectations.
And how long did you work on this series?
Well, I've been working on this. It's hard to say because I've been doing a little bit here and a little bit there for so long. You know, I became interested in this series, oh, I would have to say I'd probably be close, you know, it must be getting on a year that I've been interested in doing something. And first I put out a request. I was actually quite surprised. I put out a request to EQAO to provide me the numbers electronically to make it just a bit easier to do the analysis.
Sure.
And I was really shocked when they asked me to apply, even though everything I was asking for is on the website, on their website. And they asked me to apply and to tell them what I was doing with the numbers. I don't know, I guess it's just the journalist in me, the principal of it, but I was like, I don't need to, you know, I shouldn't have to apply to you to get public information.
Yeah.
So I never applied. I just started in and around my assignments, I started going to the website, and I do a few schools here and there every day, and I would start building an Excel spreadsheet. So it's one of those things where I've really been working on this for months and months, but it hasn't been a concentrated effort. It's been, you know, a little bit of time here and a little bit of time there to sort of eventually, you know, took time to get all of the schools into the spreadsheet. And then once I got all the schools into the spreadsheet, you take some time to do the analysis. And then I've probably been working on this dedicated for about a month now.
Right. Well, nice job. So part three runs Saturday.
Yes.
And we were talking a little bit about the content in part three, discusses a variety of topics, including, I found this interesting, you said the notion that it has become socially acceptable to be illiterate in math. Talk a bit about that and how that has come to be the case.
So this is actually one of my absolute favorite parts of the series. So, you know, of course, when I found out that so many, when I found out about these results, you know, when I looked at the Hamilton results, it's even, you know, our results are actually worse than the province in Hamilton, particularly in the public board. A lot of times the Catholic board is similar to the average. The public board is below the average. And so I was trying to look at, you know, why are we having this problem in Hamilton, and why are we having this problem really province-wide? And, you know, I'm talking to a number of experts, and the same thing kept coming up over and over again. And all of these experts were talking about how it has become socially acceptable to be illiterate in math. So their example is that they will tell people what they do for a living. So, you know, they'll say, I'm the director of math at the University of Waterloo. Mm-hmm. And the majority of responses they get are things like, oh, I'm not very good at math. I don't have a math brain. I don't have math genes. Right. My brain's not wired for math. I'm just not a math person. And, you know, they were talking about how they have friends who are English professors, and they don't get responses like that. No one says to an English professor, I can't read. I don't have a reading brain.
Yeah.
I don't know about reading. So, you know, they were talking about how it's become very socially acceptable to say that it's okay in math. And I started testing this theory out. I was asking, when I talked to school board officials, I asked about it, and they said that commonly parents will tell them that they can't help their kids out with math homework because they just don't know how to do math. And they said they don't get those kind of responses for other subjects, especially literacy. And you know, so they're really saying that, well, it's, there are a lot of factors to this problem. This is not the only thing to point at. They were talking about how this is definitely a contributor, you know, this idea that it's okay if you're not, if you don't have basic math skills, and that some people are just don't have the right brain to have basic math skills. You know, they're really trying to get across that everybody has a brain that can learn how to do math, the same as everyone has a brain that can learn how to read, and that basic math skills are very important in life. And, you know, we shouldn't be okay with being bad at math. We shouldn't be okay with saying, you know, just leaving it, I'm bad at math. And the other thing that I loved, that I have a fact box in the paper tomorrow that will go into this in detail, is they talked to me about how you can help teach your kids math, because they really feel that parents struggle with that a bit. And you know, I really related to this as a mom. You know, they talked about, as a mom, right from when your baby's born, you're told read to your baby. You know, there's the cuddle up and read programs. You go to story time at the library, you go to Mother Goose at the you know, at the early year centers. You know, I did so many literacy things. And yet they talked about how there isn't enough emphasis on doing the same things with your kids in math. And it's so easy. You know, it's as simple as, if you're baking in the kitchen, you know, have your kids come and help you. And if it calls for a cup, don't get out a cup. Get out a quarter cup and say, you know, how many times do we need to fill this up until we're at a cup? Or if you go shopping, you talk about, you know, how the peanut butter costs more than the jam, or, you know, what is the best buy when you're looking at the grapes. You know, it was so many things. Even taking a walk, you can look for patterns. And you can talk about shapes. There was just so many easy ways to help your children be, you know, to help your children get those skills. And I just think that that is such an important part of this story, and a part of the story that I don't hear talked about very often.
Mm-hmm. It's a sort of a cultural piece in a sense, I suppose, you know, when you look at it that way, in terms of the culture of what's acceptable and what's not. And that's a great point. You know, a few people would say, yeah, you know, I don't... I can't speak very well, or I can't read. You know, even if they don't read that well, it's not something you'd readily admit to. But the math, that seems you know, fair game for people to admit to that. So
yes,
it's interesting. Let's talk about some of the feedback you've received on the series, because education, it's always a hot button issue, mm-hmm. I think. And before we get into sort of the broader feedback you've received in general, yeah. I have to ask you.
I know what's coming.
I have to ask you about one, you know, wonderful series. There was some math questions included in the
yes.
paper.
Can you do the math?
Can you do the math? That was in, what day was that in the paper?
That it's in every day of the series, but what you're referring to is the first day.
The first day. And there was a particular math question and a wrong answer supplied in the paper. So talk a little bit about the blowback from that and what happened.
Oh my gosh. I guess the answer to can you do the math is no. here at the Spectator. That I still, okay, when it comes to how it happened, I actually have no idea how it happened because... you know, I don't think people are necessarily familiar with our process, but we are turning things around rather quickly. But, you know, we do spend a lot of time. I spent hours and hours proofing pages. Every single day I've spent hours rereading pages, going over every number, every mm-hmm. name, every fact, every calculation. And it's just a simple matter of somehow the can you do the math just got missed when it came to proofing the pages. I still don't know how that happened because there was not just myself, but many of us proofing the pages. And somehow that element... was overlooked, and we hadn't actually done the equation. That's the problem. We usually do the equations. When I do the proof, I actually do the math, but
oh, right.
because no one proofed that page, no one did the equation. So it just happened. What happened was we just had the wrong answer booklet. When the question booklet and the answer booklets are not together, they're separate,
mm-hmm.
and we accidentally used the wrong answer booklet to answer that question, which is how the wrong answer got in there in the first place. But oh my gosh, did we learn, well, at least I learned people are reading the series, because I basically had to put on my phone that the answer to the question is 651. I'm now having nightmares about the number 651. It like chases me in my sleep. I had to put on my voicemail that the answer was 651 and turn my phone right down because it never stopped.
You actually put the right answer on your voicemail response.
On my voicemail.
Yeah, yeah.
Because my phone never stopped ringing all day. My phone number's at the bottom of the story. So everybody called me. I started getting phone calls and emails started probably like 6:30 or 7 a.m. And we fixed it very quickly online, but of course you can't fix it in the paper.
Sure.
So first of all, I just can't even tell you how crushing and disappointing it is to discover this in the paper.
Right.
But it was, but I have to look at the silver lining. It was just in some ways so great to see so many people engaging with this series, because I had to keep answering emails all day long. I would get these poor people who would email me and say, I have been working on this for an hour and I can't figure out why I can't get the right answer. And I had to, you know, respond to all them like, yes, the answer is actually 651. I had some, my favorite was a group of guys that called me from Tim Hortons. It was a group of math teachers,
mm-hmm.
And they are between the ages of 80 and 92, they said, and they told me that they had been doing this question for an hour and that it was absolutely not right. The answer was no way was it right. And of course I had to tell them that, you know, they're right, the answer's wrong. And so first I got schooled on always double checking your work, which is the lesson of the day here,
right.
And then they told me, they said, well, we'll give you a get out of jail free pass this time, but don't make us call you again,
right.
So a salute to the math group at Tim Hortons. And but I had some very nice messages, you know, people messaging me things like, you know, the error is human. And someone else sent me an email about how this was just a classic blooper, that in a series about how kids can't do math, we have the wrong answer to the math,
right.
Problem. And, you know, she was saying someday you will laugh about this, which I responded, I really hope so. I'm still not quite there yet,
right.
Laughing about it. But
you should have told the math group at the Down Hortons that this was just a test for them to see if they would catch the error. Right? It was totally intentional. But
yes, we had to rerun the question. And if you could believe it, I am still, even though it's been corrected now in the newspaper and corrected online, I am still getting people phoning and
wow.
emailing me saying, I just want to let you know that I think your answer is wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's the old story. I mean, we certainly we don't get calls. You're not going to get calls from people saying, "Oh, congratulations on all the correct answers in the paper."
Yes.
It's the one outlier that's going to get the attention.
Well, we deserve it on this one.
Yeah. Now, more to the broader feedback, of course, you're getting a lot of you're hearing from readers a lot because it is such a big issue. What's been your takeaway from the response you're getting from readers in terms of the message that the series is delivering?
Well, first of all, people are very interested and passionate about this issue. It's something that they care about a lot. And it's something that I think people are frustrated with, rightly, because, you know, one of the things I found most shocking when I was doing this series is that this has been a problem for at least a decade, if not more. And it's not that it's a problem that is stagnant. It is a problem that is declining. And, you know, Hamilton public schools have seen their scores drop by about 10 percentage points in merely 4 years for both grade 3 and grade 6. It is falling fast. You know, it is a very steady decline over 9 years. There have been task forces set up to look at it. There have been, you know, so many different people that have looked at it, and so far nothing seems to be fixing it yet. So I think there's a real frustration out there. And I have to say, the big hot button issue is inquiry-based learning. So I am getting a lot of emails where it's very clear that a lot of people feel the culprit is inquiry-based learning. For anyone who doesn't know inquiry-based learning, it is an approach to teaching where, instead of just being presented with the information, lessons, you learn more from asking questions, from going off of things that kids are interested in, right, from allowing kids to investigate things on their own, mm-hmm. Of course facilitated by a teacher. But it's a bit different than just sitting at your desk and getting, you know, being given the information. Instead, it, you know, goes off kids' observations and their ideas and lets them sort of work through the problems themselves to learn and come up with the mm-hmm. answers that way.
Right.
And a lot of people feel that we really need to get back to the basics in math, and that while inquiry-based learning has a place and is important, that when it comes to math, there needs to be a bit more emphasis on the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. So that is one very large stream of opinion that is out there.
Right.
The other issue that I'm hearing about a lot, which has been identified now by many of the task force that look into this, is that elementary teachers do not require any background in math to become an elementary teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really need some support in becoming and learning how to be better math teachers, and making sure they have the fundamental skills themselves to they really need some support. And so the province has included that in its renewed math strategy. It includes, you know, setting math leads at schools where those teachers would go and get professional development in math, and then they would come back and provide that to their school. The Hamilton school boards have these math specialists who they would be assigned certain schools, and they would go in and help the teachers at that school do lesson planning. They also work in the classroom. So, you know, there's many different ways right now that are being looked at to help boost teachers' skills mm-hmm. in math. Because, you know, one of the reports I read, it really struck me that it talked about how a teacher's own view of math can really shape kids' views of math, which is really important at a time when we're talking about a society, you know, being okay with math literacy. It was talking about how, you know, a teacher who's good at math and who likes math can really instill that in their students. You know, it talked about how, this was an Ontario task force that talked about how, you know, kids have a natural inquisitiveness and a natural curiosity that can really go well with learning math if a teacher is interested in math and excited about math. But it talked about how a teacher that's really uncomfortable with math, that teachers that are uncomfortable with math themselves and who dislike math themselves, that can end up passing that on to kids.
Yeah.
Which, and for parents out there, when, you know, was something for parents out there, the same thing can happen. You know, as a parent, if you're constantly saying to your kid when they're bringing you their math homework, I don't like math, I'm not good at math, or, you know, I don't know math, I can't help you with that, then that can really have an impact on your kids. That really can start to pass on your own stereotypes and your own anxieties about math to your kids. So I think mm-hmm. that's, you know, a really important takeaway from this. is that, you know, we need to start from a place where we're positive about math and where we believe that all people can learn math.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, yeah, 'cause it's that combination, I guess, with many things in education or even life, where you've got the parent, you have the teacher, and in a perfect world, they're both trying to, you know, inspire the child to embrace the subject, you know. Mm-hmm. I think I was always fairly negative on math with my kids, now that you mentioned that, you know, in terms of, you know, that I wasn't very good at math, and I would say that. But, and then also I think with a lot of kids, and thinking my own son and so on, that math isn't just sort of memory work. I mean, math can be difficult, and maybe it's also part of a culture where sometimes if a child is feeling like they can't, if they feel like they're frustrated with it, mm-hmm. there might be an inclination to say, well, then don't do that. Do what you can succeed in. But sometimes you just gotta kind of keep taking the, you know, failing and coming back for more and getting extra help and working at it. And that can be a tough thing, I guess, for some children and some parents to want to go through that.
Oh, well, and I have to say, when I was listening to these professors, like, you know, I'm a journalist, so math is not my specialty. Although I have to say, I've increasingly had to learn math to do my job. But at the same time, I'm not someone that, you know, intuitively, math is intuitive to me. So, you know, when these professors were talking about some of these attitudes or things you say to your kids or things you just say that you don't even realize that your kids might be listening to, I was just thinking in my head, I was like, oh, guilty, guilty, guilty myself, right? Like, I was like, oh my gosh. And I was thinking, you know, have I done these things with my kids? You know, all these math things that I'm much more conscious of it now. And some of the schools had, one of the schools, Canadian Martyrs, I talked to its principal, and I really loved one of the things that they did is they're trying to get parents a bit more involved in math. And they had a Lego night where they said it was really well attended, very popular, where they had this Lego night where they had students come in and parents come in, and they had different stations set up, and it was all based around math learning, but it was all playing with Lego. And they said the kids really enjoyed it and the parents had fun with their kids, but it also helped give parents those tools to be like, so you know, these are some things you can do yourself at home to help your kid with math. You know, sometimes it can be as easy as having a family board game night. There's lots of board games like Yahtzee and Monopoly and Snakes and Ladders that are very math based. And so, you know, a lot of these things aren't as difficult as we might think they are to help, and can really help kids out with math.
Right. Huh. Well, great, great, great advice there, Joanna, and great series. And we'll look forward to the part three. And do you think you'll follow up on this some more in the future in terms of where it goes from here?
Oh, I'm sure. I think this is such an important issue and such a long-standing issue that I definitely think, you know, it's something that we'll keep an eye on. And especially now that the province has a renewed math strategy, you know, we'll have to, it'll be a ways down the road before we see results from that, but it'll be worth, you know, keeping an eye on this. And and also I'm getting a lot of feedback from the series. I'm sure I'll get a lot tomorrow, so I'm sure there'll be maybe some follow-up stories out of, you know, some of those emails and phone calls I get, because they really help you, I'm sure as you know from your own stories, they can really help you find a direction that you didn't that you didn't see. We do so much research on these projects, but there's such big topics that there's no way you can possibly cover them all. So, you know, it's through the feedback sometimes that you get some really great ideas for new directions for the story.
Right. Terrific. Well, Joanna, thanks for the time. Thanks for the chat.
Great. It was fun.
Now I'm with Spectator Editor-in-Chief Paul Burton. Paul, thanks for being with me.
Happy to be here.
The Spec is publishing a huge special section this weekend to mark Canada's 150th birthday. Paul, talk a little bit about the content in the section. I understand it's 88 pages long and blends the past and the present. Talk a little bit about what readers will find in the section.
Well, I mean, in many ways, it's a walk back through history, as you might expect, but I like to think it's also a reflection on our present and our future. As most good reflections are. And so while, you know, there is a great deal of thoughtful pieces by the likes of you, John, and many other of the Spectator's best writers, there's also, you know, a lot of photographs from our archives and stories from the Canadian press about the big events in the country's history.
The Spectator, certainly since I've been here, we've often put out special sections. Over the years, we put out some big special sections, and they require a lot of work by a lot of people. They're big undertakings and sort of done on the side as the regular papers put out. Why do you think it's important to devote resources to something like this?
Yeah, you know, I think as someone who studied history, I will just use the old line: if we don't know where we've been, we can't possibly figure out where we're going. And you know, newspapers are great for that. And we have probably the biggest archive of information this side of the public library, maybe the universities, but maybe it's bigger than both of them combined. I mean, the newspaper has been documenting the daily life of Hamilton for 171 years. So we've got a lot to share with the community. But there's also, you know, the sections also use some of the material that was printed in 1967, and it gives readers a chance to look back at what we were thinking then about where we might be now, and you know, how we've matched it or how we haven't.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, you know, this we could do a few podcasts on this topic, but we live in interesting times. As I'm not sure who coined that phrase, it is repeated a lot, but we live in interesting times. So when you think of Canada at 150, what do you think of in terms of where we're at in the context of the world that we live in today? It's a pretty broad question, but the age of Trump, and the technological age, the consumer age, what do you think about where we stand as a country at this point?
Yeah, you know, I think Canadians feel pretty good about themselves. We felt pretty good about ourselves 50 years ago in 1967 during our centennial too, I suppose. But I think Canadians are happy with where we've come and, generally speaking, where we're going. And that's, you know, that's a terrific thing. But many countries would say that. I think what sections like this do, you know, they don't probably do well in sort of dissecting the things that we haven't done so well or the things that we're not doing so well today. Newspapers are good at that, of course. But, you know, while there's a lot to celebrate about our 150th birthday, there's also a lot that's not worth celebrating. And we touch on some of them in the section about some of the things we failed at or some of the things that we could have done better at. And, you know, as I say, it's important to include all of them so we can chart a better course for the future. Generally speaking, I think readers will be really happy with what we've done. It's interesting, it's educational, and it's both forward-looking and back-looking. And the interesting thing is that we look back to where they were looking forward, which I find an interesting twist on these things.
Right. I wanted to ask you, you know, I think for a few generations of Canadians, you know, looking back, and for a lot of people, a writer sort of synonymous with Canada in many ways was your father, Pierre Burton, who died in 2004. And he was called by the Governor General at the time the most remarkable writer of Canadian historical events in the last 50 years, which is quite amazing praise. And he wrote acclaimed histories on such things as the Canadian North and the railway, the War of 1812, Vimy Ridge, and whatnot. I can't help but wonder, you know, how, in terms of your own personal context, in terms of how you experience Canada and view Canada, you know, that your father, you know, writers become immersed in subjects for a variety of reasons. Why do you think your father immersed himself in Canada's history? It became his muse, I suppose, if I'm phrasing that correctly. Well, why do you think that became his thing? And I don't know, did that have any impact on you growing up in terms of your view of the country and your place in it?
Yeah, I don't suppose it could. I could have avoided it having an effect on the way I view the country. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's obvious. In terms of what motivated him, I'm not sure. I think in early days, he simply saw an opportunity to tell good stories that hadn't been told. Mm-hmm. as he progressed through his writing career, and indeed his career as a, you know, a journalist and a public speaker and a sort of a television show host and a maker of documentary films, all kinds of other things, I think he felt an obligation to the country to help them tell our stories and unite the country through that writing and through that exposition. And I think he took that more seriously every day. He was a big believer in Canada. He loved the country, and he loved writing about it, and he loved sharing stories about it. But most of all, he liked nation building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think some people would argue that that was one of his great legacies, playing a role in that. I guess, you know, finally bring you back to a narrow sense, the local sense, the spectator. You know, we often, myself and others here, often write about the city's past in one way or another, calling upon some of the historical context and so on. Why do you think it's important for us to do that? To, you know, I wrote a piece I've written a piece on Vimy Ridge in World War I, and Jeff Mahoney will often bring in historical context. Paul Wilson has been famous for that, most notably over the years. Why do you think that's important for the paper?
Well, I'll start by repeating what I said earlier. We can't know where we're going until we figure out where we've come from. And, you know, we should all know that. It's very, very important. And in order to be a responsible citizen, you need to know about your community. And a newspaper like the Hamilton Spectator feels an obligation, not just needs to, but feels an obligation to tell our readers and our residents and our taxpayers about their community, not just to connect them, but so that they can improve the lot of all of us and the prosperity of the city as a whole. And I don't think that we can underestimate the role of newspapers in doing that for the last several hundred years. Unfortunately, these days, maybe it is being underestimated, but, you know, we have a huge archive here that is priceless and will be used by our successors and our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, for many, many centuries to come. It's just invaluable, and we collect that history every day, and without it, I really think the community would be a shadow of itself without a written document that tells not just ourselves but our children about our daily lives and struggles and challenges and triumphs and tragedies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I mean, oftentimes if I'm writing a piece on an issue, a local issue, LRT, whatever it might be, I'll go back and look in our archives to see what's been written before. As you said, oftentimes it's interesting, it's entertaining, and it's also informative to look at what people were thinking was going to happen, what was the calamity that might happen about this or that.
And sometimes it's prescient, and sometimes it's just funny.
Yeah, it's amazing. And but I guess the old, you know, learning from the past, so you're not doomed to repeat the bad things are all part of that. But anyway, well, Paul, congratulations on the special section.
Thank you very much. It was a big piece of teamwork on the part of the newsroom, so they are the one that deserve the congratulations.
Thanks for this, Paul.
Thank you.
And finally, in this episode, The Spectator publishes an 88-page special section this weekend to mark Canada's 150th birthday. Section editor Jeff Day asked several reporters to write pieces for the section. He provided no parameters other than to write something about Canada and its meaning to us. I don't often write stories in first person, but felt this was the approach to take here. I decided to reflect upon Hamilton's place in Canada as I reached 20 years working with The Spectator and as I approached my 50th birthday in August. I titled the piece, A Reporter's Journey in Canadatown. Birthdays can inspire celebration and melancholy, marking the beginning but also the journey, and reflection on an uncertain future. At least that's how it feels when your 50th looms, if you have a tendency to study upon such things. I always had a love-hate relationship with my birthday, or more specifically, my birth date. at the end of August. As a kid, I thought I was cheated out of the joy of anticipating it, because doing so meant wishing away summer in favor of school starting, which is surely way too much contemplation for a 10-year-old. It's a challenge wrapping your head around the meaning of a milestone birthday, of fate, blessings, and roads taken and not taken. And that's just for one person, but for a nation, the second largest on the planet. I could pretend I'm well positioned to expound upon Canada's 150th as a centennial baby born during Expo 67 in Montreal and in that very city. But capturing all that is Canada is daunting. Roll the visuals, forests and mountains and frozen tundra and sparkling lakes, maple leaf face painted kids, the Peace Tower, forever cool, and CN Tower, not anymore. Maybe it's better to localize, reel in those panoramic visions, because in the end, no one can feel a whole country. So shrink it down to what? Your neighborhood? Your family? Yourself? Widen the circle a bit more to your city, Hamilton, which, as it happens, is perfect for the occasion of Canada's 150th, because Hamilton is arguably the country's most distinctly Canadian city. That is, if an alien landed and said, "Show me Canada," you could do worse than bring the creature here. Or, to borrow from Esquire magazine, whose masthead boasts, "Man at his best, Hamilton is Canada at its best." It's a thesis I unwittingly began working on when I landed at the Hamilton Spectator 20 years ago this spring, my hair cut high and tight, clean-shaven and wearing a tie each day. There was not one single all-Canadian moment that brought that realization into focus for me. A couple jumped to mind, though, one heavy, one light. Heavy. A gentle breeze touching faces gathered along Main Street one October evening as Nathan Cirillo returns home, the sidewalks packed with people wrapped in red and white, yearning to get closer to the slain soldier. Scribbling in my notebook, feeling the city's collective heart swelling, and later that night, hitting the last stroke on my keyboard, handing off the story to my editor, Cheryl, and trying to hold back tears. Hamilton. Light. Showing up on short notice, at First Ontario Centre with spec photographer Barry Gray, what other major arena in the country could you do this at, where a trainer hands me a Bulldogs jersey to wear and a hockey stick, and I skate alone on freshly polished ice so I can narrate a video recalling the Gretzky to Lemieux Canada Cup 87 game-winning goal, arguably Canada's greatest hockey moment, an event that essentially christened state-of-the-art Cops Coliseum in a city denied an NHL team in seeming perpetuity. Hamilton is a microcosm of Canada crystallized in many smaller glimpses, the education of a reporter who thought he knew something about the city, but did not. Soon after I was hired at the Spectator, I was assigned to write a ward profile for a city election. I drove to the northern edge of the ward's boundary, which I discovered to my delight was a beach, one that had, pre-waterfront trail, a raw and undiscovered vibe to it. I walked in the sand to the edge of Lake Ontario because I could. I grew up in flat and landlocked London, Ontario. And so my lead in that ward profile story read, quote, "A valley, mountain, beach, and lake define Ward 5," unquote. As though this was news. Clearly, I was awestruck by the geography. My first love for Hamilton was purely physical. Geologic forces over thousands of years created the setting. Glaciers advancing and retreating, forging the lake and the harbor, protected by a sandbar 6 kilometers long, that turned Hamilton into an industrial powerhouse. I became a Southern Ontario boy because of my dad's fears of Quebec separatists. When I was 6, he uprooted us from Montreal. When my parents heard rumors of London's bland landscape, they had never visited Ontario prior to moving day, they sold our little 16-foot sailboat and also the downhill ski equipment in favor of cross-country gear. My first newspaper job was at the Mitchell Advocate, 45 minutes north of London. Then, 15 minutes west of there, the Huron Expositor in Seaforth, then north to Port Elgin at Shoreline News, back south to the Guelph Tribune, and finally the Spec. I was 29 when I started here, recently married, no kids, and now I've got two decades under my belt, exploring Hamilton, digging into its past, paddling and hiking the terrain, writing about this most Canadian of cities. Why most Canadian? Certainly Toronto can't make that claim, because what Torontonians yearn to be is New York. And in any case, Hogtown is too big and self-important to be considered distinctly Canadian. Hamilton, a large Canadian city with a small feel that sits near the U.S. border, like 75% of the country's population, and is representative of Canada's physical geography with its escarpment, valleys, and Great Lake. Like Canada, Hamilton's economic DNA evolves. Steel Town endures, long may the title live, but more as a metaphor for the city's grit. Today, it is world-class medicine, the arts. And agriculture. We remain the country's broccoli and cauliflower capital. Hard to believe, but nearly 80% of Greater Hamilton is rural, with about 8,000 hectares of potential prime farmland. Its people come from across the globe, a place of ivory tower academics and bohemian artists and blue-collar workers. It is a carnival of characters, heroes of uncommon valor, and the worst of villains. It is the wealthy and desperately poor, the quirky and brilliant, generous and strong. I write these words from home. On the wall behind me hangs a wartime poster of Winston Churchill, and also a painting of Churchill's home called Chartwell. The artist is a woman named Lydia Knox Hill. I met Lydia 5 years ago. She lived with her cat, Buster, in an old house downtown crowded with art and plants. As a teenager, her family fled Lithuania near the end of the Second World War, and she witnessed terrible things that haunted her dreams. Maybe that was why she often painted beauty, flowers and lighthouses, horses and fields and wind-blown trees. After a profile I wrote about her appeared in the Spec, I visited again. She made tea. I noticed she only briefly dipped the bag. Quote, "I like my tea so mild you wouldn't believe it," she said. Quote, "I just color it. It was the war," unquote. Every time I wait a few beats for tea to steepen my mug, I think of Lydia. I'm 6'2", and at the front door when I said goodbye, she wrapped her arms around me, barely coming up to my chest, and hugged hard. Hamilton. Finally, like Canada, this city is all about place, all about being here. Take in select parts and you miss it entirely. That includes those who merely catch a glimpse while hurtling across the skyway, unable to transcend that fire-breathing industrial postcard, to linger in the light and music of a cafe or gallery, float down a placid creek, walk corridors of the past along the Bruce Trail, or feel mist from a teeming waterfall. Those just passing through will never appreciate the layers to this textured, resilient, and big-hearted city, the most Canadian there is, as a Spectator reporter observed in an article more than a decade ago. You could look it up. I'm the one who wrote it. Canada Town? Has a nice ring to it. Probably won't catch on, but that's fine. Hamilton doesn't seek the title. Happy birthday, Canada. And on behalf of Canada Town, you're welcome. Thanks for listening. I'm John Wells.